Hello, everybody. I want to welcome you all to our class on Kabbalah. It's pain-free Kabbalah for tarot readers. It's not Kabbalah for yeshiva students. It's not Kabbalah for New Age people. It's not Kabbalah for all sorts of other reasons. It's Kabbalah for tarot, and it's a very particular kind, a very special branch of Kabbalah. And we're going to cover an enormous amount of material. It's going to be a very, very strong course. And you guys are going to be completely stuffed. Your brains are going to be fried by the time we do this, but hopefully it'll stay with you. And as much as that's true, and remember this is an 8-hour course, and it will be 8 solid hours, all of it that you're going to get, as much as it is going to be just the very, very beginning. But even so, you are going to have an enormous amount of material to work with, and it should enrich your experience of tarot by a great deal. It'll give you a lot of power, it'll give you a lot of resources, it'll give you a lot of understanding, and it'll make all those books you read suddenly mean something. All those references and all those attributions that you see, you know, at the first page of every major arcana card, where they're beginning to tell you, you know, what the colors and the numbers are, and what the intelligences and functions and letters and all those things you see in those books will suddenly begin to make sense. Not only will you have heard them, but you'll know where they fit in a very, very large, very elaborate system. And this is what we're doing here. Speaking about that, why we're here, there are people here from a variety of places, people who come to tarot and to Kabbalah from several different locations. Some people come to it, you know, knowing little or nothing about either tarot or Kabbalah. Some people come with a considerable amount of background. It's just that Kabbalah is something that they find to be a hole, a gap in their education, and they want to fill it. We have one person in class who is a Hebrew speaker, and Hebrew is the original and basic language of Kabbalah. And we have all kinds of places to begin from. But mostly, we are primarily here to strengthen and deepen our knowledge of tarot. I should ask you whether or not that's true. Am I making an assumption that I shouldn't be making?
It's true for me.
Is there anybody for whom it is not true? Is anybody here for reasons beyond that, just curiosity perhaps? I know that one person that we have here is a member of our live class in New York and is here because it's a requirement for a degree and must be done. But hopefully, even if those things are true, the main reason would still be to come away with a deeper knowledge of tarot. And there's another thing. In the beginning of one's study of tarot, and going all the way through it, even when you become a real old hand and you've been doing this for 20 years, there is a question. It's a question that one asks at the beginning and in the middle and at the end of one's study of tarot. And that question is one you'll all recognize. It's, what do the cards mean? What do those cards mean? And we spend a tremendous amount of time, we spend almost all of our teaching time trying to get that question answered. I mean, here you have these 78 beautiful and enigmatic images with their names and their numbers arranged, you know, in a deck, and you put them out on the table in front of you, you take them out of the box when you're first beginning, and you look at them and you say, what in the world is this? And so you go to class or you read some books, and you still ask, what is this? What does this mean? What's it about? And you're constantly adding more and more information to answer that question. You need to do that all the time. But the interesting thing is that the actual answer to the question is a one-word answer. And this goes for all the cards, simultaneously. The answer is, they don't mean anything. Does that tickle you at all? Do you not believe me? It's literally true.
Yeah.
They mean nothing. Because the question is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you do a reading, one of the main things you want to do when you do a reading is get a good question. And because without a good question, it's hard to come up with a good answer. So what I'm going to tell you is that the question as to what the cards mean is wrongly phrased. Because they have different qualities for different kinds of people who come to them. There are those people who are the general public and one's clients who are not students of tarot, they just come to get readings. And for them, tarot and all of its cards and images are just interesting images, interesting names, mysterious, possibly powerful, and they come to find out what it all can do for them, and they've heard that you can do these amazing and possibly miraculous things with them, but they don't really know much beyond that, and they look at the cards with a certain amount of shiver, perhaps. To readers, of whom there are many, many these days, and to students at the beginning of the path, there is another level to that. All the images have the quality of evoking emotional response. If you look at the death card, or the devil, or the tower, which have, you know, very melodramatic aspects to the pictures, they bring up certain qualities in you. They make you think certain things. They make you reach into your memory and come up with ways in which they refer to your own life and to the life experience of those you know. They're very evocative. And the attempt is made, when teaching tarot, the attempt is made to capture those evocations of powerful emotion in keywords and key phrases and key concepts. And then the study of tarot becomes mostly a matter of memorizing and organizing those key concepts and words, and then using them in a reading, hopefully as gracefully as you can, and adding to that, you know, that mix, your own personal experience and your own ability to speak, to be intelligible and articulate. But that's where most tarot ends. That's where the study of tarot ends for an awful lot of people. But the evocation of emotion, the evocation of personal intuitive meanings, that's not by any stretch of the imagination all there is to tarot. And luckily there are more and more people in a third category, and they are serious students. And when I say serious, that means that they're willing to go beyond that first stage. They're willing to look for deeper stuff. They know there's got to be more to it than that. And for those students, tarot is, the images of tarot are mnemonic devices, memory devices, flashcards, reminders of a system of knowledge, a very deep, very complex, very multi-layered system of knowledge that lies behind the images. It's a language of pictures, a language of symbols, and the language is as complicated as any language you've ever heard of. But it's rich, and it's deep, and it's what gives tarot all the things that we think of as meaning. So that's why we're here, to answer that question of what the cards mean. And in this case, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking for meaning in the system of knowledge that lies behind the pictures. And it's very systematic, and it's very capable of being learned. It just takes a little while. So then the question becomes, why are we studying Kabbalah? And what does that have to do with tarot? And the answer to that is that the knowledge system of Kabbalah is the source of both meaning and image in the tarot decks and systems of, oh, say, the last 150 years. There was a time when tarot did not necessarily, we don't know for sure, but it didn't necessarily have anything to do with Kabbalah. And we can't say that because there aren't any records that indicate that. Historically speaking, you can't be sure whether Kabbalah was part of the creation of tarot or not. But there did come a time when the clear equivalence of the system that underlies Kabbalah and the system that underlies tarot was seen to be so exact, it was seen to be such a fit, that the two things were put together by esotericists, by magicians, by ceremonial magicians, and by people who worked with magical systems in Europe. It was put together by them 150 years ago approximately, and it has not been separated since. And the decks that came out of those times, the decks that came out of the Golden Dawn, the decks that came out of the French systems and other European systems, changed. They were different. And they reflect this new combination of tarot and Kabbalah and all the meanings that we're used to in modern times. When you look at a card and you're familiar with what it's supposed to mean, that meaning and even that picture comes out of the basic relationship to Kabbalah. That's mostly where it comes from. So the reason for studying Kabbalah is first of all, to have available to you that system of knowledge, and to make it practical, to make it a practical, useful knowledge that you can use in readings. And it's extremely valuable. You will find it to be so. The layers of meaning, the layers of knowledge, give you texture, give you subtlety, give you range and breadth and depth that go a lot further than common sense or what it called intuitive, grasp of things. Even the best of life experiences, even the most wide and far-ranging of personal life experience cannot match by any stretch of the imagination, cannot match the breadth and power of the Kabbalistic system. So you're going to be given this huge, powerful tool to be used, at your leisure when you need it. You're also going to learn something that will let you know tarot so deeply that you can use tarot to know yourself deeply. Part of the reason for working with tarot, of course, is to do readings for other people, but how much good are you going to be able to do someone else if you're not very useful to yourself? How much can a dysfunctional person help another dysfunctional person? Hard to do. So the more you have in the way of wisdom and understanding and knowledge, the more you'll be able to help anybody who comes into your orbit, and you'll also be able to help yourself. And everybody needs to be able to do that and to penetrate the cloud of general ignorance that we have about primal things, about who we are and why we are. Who am I and what am I? That's a good question to ask. And anybody who asks that question will end up with some form or another of philosophical, mystical, or spiritual answer. And tarot has answers like that deeply embedded in it. And another aspect of this issue of knowing yourself deeply is that you will eventually come to see tarot as a spiritual path. You may or you may not want to follow it, but you could if you wanted to, if you knew this material. You have a doorway to enter that particular place. And it's not a doorway that's open to everybody. You do need to know something to do that. So those are the reasons we're here. Those are the reasons we're studying. Those are the reasons why we're doing this particular stuff. And hopefully I'll be able to back up these things that I'm saying with actual material, and you'll see as we go along. Does anybody have any questions or comments before, I go any further?
Walt, this is Adele. I joined a little bit late. Do we need a deck of cards to work with now?
No.
Okay.
For tonight and for a little bit of time, you're not going to need any cards. And we will be needing cards before the work is done. But you will begin to see the relevance of the Kabbalistic material to the deck without having the cards in front of you. You'll be able to do that anyway.
Okay.
Good. Anything else, anybody?
This is Gail, and I just wanted to say it's that layers of knowledge thing that gets overwhelming sometimes with the cards.
It does. It does. But, people who get through high school these days, before they ever get to college, have already acquired a massive amount of knowledge, little bit by little bit over 12 years, and then finally when they get to college, they can apply that to a higher level of learning and hopefully begin to apply that in practical careers and in other practical ways. When you begin to study mathematics, when you're very, very young and at the very beginning of everything, they tell you 1 + 1 = 2. And they go from there. And they teach you little bit by little bit by little bit, and you pile and acquire knowledge, one piece on top of another, and almost without you realizing it, you become very, very sophisticated in due course. But there's no rush. And by the time we're finished here, you'll become a lot more sophisticated, and a lot of this material will be presented to you, hopefully, in a way that will be easy to remember, easy to grasp, easy to take away with you and to use. You'll see. I hear a snort of no confidence.
No, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. So, now let me begin to give you some actual material, begin to talk about Kabbalah a little bit. The first thing I'm going to tell you is what the word Kabbalah means. I mean, it actually means something. It's not just a random phrase. Kabbalah means receiving, because Kabbalah is an oral tradition. Kabbalah even the name Kabbalah is fairly late in the process. The material that is presently called Kabbalah is pretty old. In fact, it's quite antique. And it acquired the name Kabbalah, you know, maybe 800 years ago, approximately. And it's probably at least 1,000 years older than that, maybe even beyond. But it means receiving. The information, the understanding and the knowledge and the wisdom were passed from the word, from the mouth of a teacher to the ear of a student, one person at a time. It was very, very slow. And for a great deal of its early history, it was hidden material, esoteric in the original sense of that word, esoteric meaning inward, inner, not visible. And actually, it was even occult in the sense that it was purposely and intentionally kept hidden. It wasn't meant for the general public, sometimes because it was politically dangerous to do so, and sometimes for other reasons, but it was a very, very elite group who had this information available to them. It's supposed to be, theoretically, the material goes back to the time before the beginning of the Christian era, and the material that is specifically Kabbalistic, what we recognize now as the system of Kabbalah, probably started just around that time, just around the time of the birth and death of Christ and the time when the Roman Empire became an empire. So it's about 2,000 years old as it stands now, with a much older tradition going back behind that. What you should know is that Kabbalah has a number of branches. It's a tree with three main branches. There came a time when Kabbalah received its name, somewhere around the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th. And Kabbalah was called Kabbalah then, and it was specifically a form of Jewish mysticism and philosophy and theology. It was a kind of Jewish religious tradition of the explanation of how the world came to be. And it was very powerful stuff. It had loads and loads of fascinating material in it. And it became appropriate at a certain point for the church to use it, to take it and try to make it prove church doctrine. There was a great deal of competition between various religious forms and factions. The church did attempt to make Kabbalah prove Christian dogma rather than Jewish dogma. There was a translation made of the Kabbalah, or certain portions of the Kabbalah, and that form of it, the form of Kabbalah that was taken over and used by the church for its own purposes, was spelled a different way than the form of it that was called Jewish. At the same time that that was happening, precisely at the same time, there was a group of people who were interested in magic, who were ceremonial magicians, and who were interested in the magical perception of the universe. And they also found Kabbalah extremely interesting and useful. And they took it and used it for their purposes. And so another spelling was given to it, and another tradition was born. And that third tradition, the magical tradition of Kabbalah, is what we are working with here, and it's generally speaking called Hermetic, H-E-R-M-E-T-I-C. And the reason it's called Hermetic is because the founder of the occult tradition was supposed to be Hermes, the Greek god Hermes, and also known as the Egyptian god Thoth, T-H-O-T-H. So Hermes was the lord of magic, and those things that were called magical were called Hermetic. And the Hermetic tradition took Kabbalah and made it pretty much the blueprint of most of its work from then on. And that eventually led to the creation of tarot it didn't lead necessarily to the creation of tarot, but it certainly led to the infusing of tarot with magical material and became, and so the material we're using here is called Hermetic Kabbalah, and that's what is appropriate to the practice and knowledge of tarot. The way we spell those things, the three spellings are the following. The Jewish form of Kabbalah is spelled with a K. You may have found these three spellings in various places and been somewhat confused by it. Here's what it is. Kabbalah with a K. Yeah, K-A-B-B-A-L-A-H is a traditional standard spelling of the Jewish form of Kabbalah. That could be called perhaps the trunk of this tree and the main branch of it. And it's still very strong and very powerful and very, very much alive to this very day. The second form, the Christian form of it, is generally spelled with a C, which you'd think would be appropriate. The C version of Kabbalah is spelled C-A, B as in boy, A-L-A. C-A-B-A-L-A. Sometimes they add an H to the end of that too, but most of the time not. So spelled with a C is the Christian form of Kabbalah. The last form, the one that we see most often in connection with tarot, is spelled with a Q. And that's Q-A-B-A-L-A-H. And that's where we are going to find most of our work tonight. Some of the work is going to be connected with the Jewish form of Kabbalah because it must be. The original ideas, the original conceptions, the original language is all Jewish. It's all Hebrew. And it is still true. And Hermeticists have found it necessary, and probably not in the least bit unpleasant, to continue to use Hebrew as the primary form. The primary magical language of Hermeticism is Hebrew. Just as the language of the church is Latin, the language of magic, at least European magic, is Hebrew. Isn't that a strange thing? But there it is. So we are going to be working with that language. The language that we're going to be working with, the language of Kabbalah and Tarot, is a magical, symbolic language made up of words and phrases from Hebrew, concepts, ideas, connections, and attributions that come from the Jewish Kabbalah and that were modified and enhanced and taken in different directions by the Hermetic community. So that language that we're going to be speaking by the time we're done here is made up of those things. One thing you might find interesting in all of this, actually you probably will, there was a time when the argument, the deep-seated distrust and rejection that religion and science had for each other, that didn't exist. There was a time when the distrust, dislike, repudiation, and ignoring of magic by both religion and science didn't exist either. There was a time when all of those things existed as one thing. In fact, one man oftentimes was simultaneously a priest, a scientist, and a magician. The same guy. And many of the people that we know now as scientists were revered more in their day for being alchemists or other forms of magician than they were for being scientists. I'll give you an example of that. Isaac Newton, who before Einstein was probably the last great, truly incendiary force for change in the world of science, the greatest of the geniuses of science of the time before Einstein, we're going back, I believe, to the 16th century, 16th or 17th, I don't remember which, actually. I should know, but I don't. In any case, Isaac Newton was a great alchemist, and he probably spent more of his time looking for the Philosopher's Stone than he did to answers to his formulas. The same was true of other great mathematicians and other great philosophers and other great scientists, men that these days would reject magic out of hand, in those days were up to their ears in trying to make sense of the world from a magical perspective.
Is Martha. Can you name a few of those guys? And by the way, were there any women?
Actually, as far as women are concerned, there may very well be, and I don't know. In general, I could say that women were not, generally speaking, they were not invited into the council, so to speak, of magicians. Ceremonial magic was usually reserved for men, as most of the forms of power were reserved for men in those days. The magic that was available to women was of a different kind and comes more under the heading of Wicca and the various forms of pagan magic that persisted in Europe all the way from pre-Christian times to the present. So although there are and have been a number of women mentioned, I can't remember their names at this point. I'm not really familiar with the history of magic. That's not really my field. But there were some. Giordano Bruno was a name that was very, very big in the field of both magic and science, and also of religion. John Dee was a cleric, a magician, and a scientist, and the primary scientific and magical advisor for Queen Elizabeth. There were a whole bunch of people whose names were towering names at the time and are still very highly regarded in the history of science, who were also magicians.
Well, I'm sorry, can you just quickly repeat the Italian name again, please?
Giordano Bruno. G-I-O-R-D-A-N-O is the first name, and Bruno is B-R-U-N-O. A very, very major and powerful figure. And John Dee, and the D is spelled D-E-E, was similarly a great figure in both science and magic. And there were others as well. If you did a little studying, if you actually read some books on this material, you'll go back and you'll find those. There were also clerics, cardinals, bishops, and priests in the church who pursued, understood, used, and were familiar with both scientific principles and magical ones, and didn't find them in the least bit subversive or difficult to reconcile. They seemed perfectly natural. It was a completely easy combination up to a point. And then, of course, there came a time when religion and science certainly parted company. And in fact, the whole essence of science was to reject out of hand everything that couldn't be proven. And obviously, religion deals mostly in issues that can't be proven. And certainly magic is likewise. And so science parted company from both of those. And for a variety of doctrinal regions, religion parted company from magic. So in the long run, each one of those groups became separate. And each one of those groups pursued its own path separate from the others. And only in history can you find a connection. But the connection is there. And in these days, people who are interested in the magical aspect of things, people who are interested in Kabbalah, people who are interested in tarot, people who are interested in ceremonial magic, likewise, do not find spirituality, magic, and science to be particularly difficult to reconcile. Not hard at all. So I just wanted you to be aware of that. The world wasn't always the way it is now. And in modern times, the interest in Kabbalah in particular has, maybe four general approaches. There's an academic interest. There are professors and students and curricula that investigate and work with Kabbalah and perpetuate it. It's scholarly. Then there's a religious aspect to Kabbalah. Jews in particular, a certain kind of Jewish person, will pursue Kabbalah as a mystical pursuit, as a way of going to the very depths of his spiritual beliefs. There's an esoteric interest in Kabbalah. That's the magical interest. The people who pursue ceremonial magic and the people who pursue tarot on a very deep level will be particularly interested in Kabbalah because they must be. Without Kabbalah, it would be extremely difficult to make any headway in this. And then finally, there is an amateurish interest. There is the interest of people who are just curious. And they think they'd like to know about it. It's more or less, it's in vogue. It's faddish. People, you know, from movie stars to radio columnists to just your everyday Joe have all of a sudden found that Kabbalah is an interesting subject matter, and because everybody else is doing it, they're interested too. And of course, everybody has a mild interest in philosophical things, and so this is the philosophy of the day. So those things all make Kabbalah move forward. And all of those things keep Kabbalah alive and well and healthy. And the connection between Kabbalah and tarot is likewise very alive and healthy. So we're going to leave that as the background. I mean, we could do an awful lot of work on the historical background and other matters connected with that and between Kabbalah and tarot. But we are going to leave that at this point and go on to the next part.